So now, with the 1946 strike, were the planters already unionized, or is that what they were striking about, was recognition of the union?
It's recognition of the union. They were organized, but weren't recognized by the planters. So the workers were organized.
Can you talk about what the demands were for 1946 and what role the union played?
Well, the union represented the workers, so they played the lead role. And this was the first time you had a full-on strike with the ILWU representing the workers. So, and I don't remember the details about the condi- I mean wages certainly. There were a lot of comparisons between what Hawaii workers were earning as opposed to the continent, mainland United States workers were earning. So the disparity in wages was always one of the big things. I think the sheer the insistence that the union represent the workers was clearly one of the important factors there, and that the strike settled, that the after thereafter, the planters would not try even to suggest that the ILWU was not a legitimate union representing the interests of the workers. I think one of the really interesting things that illustrates this about the fact that they now really had an inter-ethnic, interracial, pretty solid working class movement was the attempt of the planters to bring in strikebreakers from the Philippines. And so it was a very highly celebrated attempt to bring in, I've forgotten the number, but it's there in the records, a group of Filipinos to help break the strike. And what happened was that the seamen on the ships that were transporting the workers organized the Filipinos so that when they came, when they disembarked in Hawaii, they joined the picket lines. Instead of becoming strikebreakers, they helped become part of the labor force.
Well, can you talk about how the union was able to bridge the ethnic divisions?
Well, the union, beginning in the late 30s and into the 40s, the organizers who came from the West Coast learned very quickly the intricacies of racial politics and racial organizing, and the necessity to force the local population to accept what we would now call affirmative action, I think, or proportional representation, where somehow, and in the case of the plantation workforce, it largely meant bringing together Japanese and Filipino workers. By the 40s, the largest number of Japanese workers was Nisei, was second generation, no longer first generation Issei. These are now American-born, American-educated workers. They know English as they know Pidgin English, but it's still English as native speakers. They grew up in the educational system, as opposed to the Filipinos who are still primarily immigrants. Not as skilled in working through the system. So the logic of sort of a natural progression was just was to have Nisei leadership. And what the ILWU leaders forced the local folks to recognize was that if they needed to include Filipino representation at leadership levels. And this was not always appreciated by the Nisei, because they felt that either the mainland Hawley organizers resented Japanese Americans or didn't adequately respect the leadership qualities they exhibited, and that they might have. So there was talk among the Japanese Americans that the Hawley organizers really wanted a weakened local representation by incorporating Filipinos. That, you know, the Filipinos would certainly not agree with that. But that was the mandate that was, I think, eventually proved to, in spite of damaging some Nisei egos, proved to have been quite effective.
And, you know, especially for my grandfather's funeral, it's like everybody refers back to 1946 and the unionization. So can you sort of talk about the significance that the 1946 strike played kind of for the future of Hawaii workers? Mm-hmm.
I think 1946 is a culminating movement strategically, because it brings the major components of the workforce together under one leadership. And it forces the Big Five Hawley leadership to acknowledge that. So once that's done, then everything subsequent in terms of social and labor history falls into place along lines that are no longer haphazard. Then you have two very well-defined competing groups for influence and control. Then you have workers, and then you have you also have the military on the other side, and you have global kind of forces that are coming in, and you have Japan coming in as another economic force. But for the time, you have the quote-unquote local workforce, and you have the Big Five management squaring off against one another, and it's a fairly well-defined world, and workers can see that they can win, that in fact they don't have to constantly lose, that there are some struggles that can be won.
And from what I saw, it seemed like the 1946 strike was a tossing away of the paternalistic gifts that the planters gave. Is that your understanding as well, that like the union seemed to know that workers needed to break themselves off from any kind of gifts that the planters were giving?
I think that's part of it. In 1946, and I know there's disagreement about this, by the way, you know, that housing, for example, is no longer a prerequisite, a freebie given by plantations, because the workers insist that they be paid wages instead of provided accommodations. Then they can buy their own houses or rent their own houses, and they're not dependent on the plantations to provide for housing in case they go on strike, and they cannot then be evicted in the way that planters did so before the war. So yeah, those are all, I think, parts of an equation that shifts so that people can see that the workers' interests are at odds with plantation interests.
I'm going to rephrase that just to get that again.
Okay.
Can you talk about a workers' movement for independence from the plantation in contrast to the paternalism that they accepted before?
Okay. In 1946, as a result of the strike, and I think that the ILWU has played a large role in educating workers to understand that paternalism is not in their interest, that they need to be provided wages that they can control in order to establish an independent frame of reference away from the plantations. And this 1946 does.
Okay.
Oh, hi.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
I just needed to put things away.
Oh, okay. Sure, no. Help yourself. Oh, okay.
So I have a question that's going to relate to 9/11. I'm supposed to make a comparison in another section about 9/11 and Pearl Harbor. So I just thought I would touch on this because you brought it up. Can you talk about the anti-Japanese sentiment in Hawaii and what influence that might have had to the local Japanese Americans right after Pearl Harbor was bombed?
I don't know. Can you restate that question?
I've heard you talk about the way that anti-Japanese sentiment was employed, or Japanese nationalism was employed as a weapon against the Japanese laborers. Mm-hmm. So what role did that kind of anti-Japanese sentiment play right after Pearl Harbor? How did that play out in Hawaii to the local Japanese folks?
Mm-hmm. There is a long history of anti-Japanese sentiment, and Gary Okihiro's Cane Fires will show you that. that in Hawaii, there's a whole set of legal, political, cultural, educational devices used to try to prevent Japanese Americans from reaching their full potential, let's say, in Hawaii before World War II. After Pearl Harbor, a lot of this becomes much more overt, and it's clear that while there are two things that become, I think, really clear after Pearl Harbor. Number one, the 37% of the population that is Japanese, of Japanese descent, first, second, third generation, have to be accommodated in some form, both during the war as a measure to prevent, let's say, race riots that would actually harm the effort to prosecute the war in the Pacific against Japan. And even after the war, that unless we kill all the Japanese Americans, somehow society has to be able to accommodate all of them into some kind of a society that is can tolerate this substantial number of people and make the society stable, if not progressive. The second thing that is clear is that there is a huge amount of antipathy, hostility towards the Japanese Americans. Certainly the white population feels it. The United States is their country. It has been bombed. The Japanese have openly declared that they are trying to liberate yellow people from Europeans and Americans, that it's a race war. The other communities, substantial communities, are Chinese, Korean, and Filipino, all of whose countries are being pillaged and ravaged by Japan. So on that kind of basis, and many of them are immigrants, so there's no love lost. And as I said, there were Korean folks training to join the military to fight the Japanese once a war broke out. So they were delighted, actually, to see a war happening, because they could foretell that an American victory would mean the end of Japanese colonization of Korea. They couldn't foresee what else was going to happen, but they could see the end of Japanese domination. So from the point of view of the military governor, for example, and leadership, there had to be crafted some kind of an overall social standing, social contract that would accommodate both the necessity of keeping the Japanese Americans aligned with the war effort and not so alienated that they would become an impediment to the war. And they had to keep the white, Native Hawaiian, and other Asian American communities able to see that anything like mass internment was counterproductive, that there had to be some equitable way of dealing with this situation such that immediate demands or urges for retaliation, for example, needed to be squelched, and that some form of positive working together needed to be forged. And that's what they had to do.
So how did they do that?
Well, one short way to answer that is to read the No Sword to Bury.
I know, that's why I'm asking you.
Well, you know, No Sword to Bury is a book that I did that started out as an oral history of a couple dozen of these 160 young Nisei guys who were prevented from enlisting in 1942. So they became labor volunteers, you know, volunteer victory, you know, volunteers, mostly out of the University of Hawaii. But that story then is overlaid by the military governor, the morale section, the civilian section, and incorporating some of the more enlightened Big Five individuals who tried to create this policy that I mentioned, to try to keep the Japanese Americans engaged in a positive fashion, as well as try to keep the other ethnic groups sensing that Hawaii was moving in the right direction.
So I have a small section on picture brides.
Okay.
And, you know, you had mentioned how Japan made it a point to have families immigrate.
Yeah.
But yet there was still a lot, like, you made it sound like it was gender equal, which it wasn't. So could you kind of talk about, despite this insistence about Japan to have families immigrate, what was that kind of gender ratio like that would then, would necessitate the need for picture brides?
Yes. Okay, so we're talking about picture brides and why, what was Japan's interest in trying to create a society or community in the United States that was not so dysfunctional as what was being reported about the Chinese and Chinatown communities. In the 1880s, the government required that 20% of the immigrants be comprised of women. Now, that's one out of five. That means that one out of four of the men would be married, and the other three would not. So, on the one hand, you did create a nucleus of single family units, of people running around, you know, schools and community groups and Buddhist churches and all the rest. So, to a certain extent, this actually helped organize a more stable community. On the other hand, you still had these other three male individuals with a lot of testosterone running around, and they're doing stuff. Certainly, even not just in Hawaii, but on the West Coast, they're. Whom do they go to? I mean, they create prostitution rings, they kidnap wives of other men. I mean, they certainly try to get them if there are no other ones available. So the picture bride institution is a natural outgrowth of the fact that there is a major gender imbalance, and the Japanese government certainly has no interest in trying to positive about trying to create conditions that are good for Japanese women. I mean, that's not what they're about. They're trying to make sure that the payments are coming back into Japan, that these people are creating conditions for not expansion of Japan overseas, but creating better conditions for Japan to be respected in the world order. So the Picture Bride institution, I think, comes out organically out of the conditions of gender imbalance.
And what was life like in Japan at that time for women? Was there, I mean, it makes it seem like women were not liberated. They definitely needed to be tied to a man, but what were the opportunities for women? And was this their own agency that they chose to go, or were they doing what their parents made them do, or was it a way for them to escape tradition? Like, what was their life like, and then what would lead to them choosing or not choosing?
Oh, interesting question. Well, you know, the Picture Bride phenomenon takes place a little before 1910, but large numbers. We're thinking 14,000-16,000 women come to Hawaii alone between about 1910 and 1920. 1920 is when Japan agrees to stop issuing passports to the women. So basically, a few come after that, but in 1924, the Exclusion Act stops all immigration from Japan to the United States. but in that period, from approximately, say, 1900 to 1920, it's a very interesting period in Japanese history. And there are a lot of folks who have been studying the status of women and what women are doing. And like in the United States, there is actually, I don't know if you call it a feminist movement, but certainly a circle of women intellectuals who are writing, who are talking about women having rights and being able to live on their own. There are two things I want to say about this. In traditional Japanese society, not because there is a value provided for women's rights, but because of the way traditional society is organized, women from the working classes certainly have a great deal more flexibility and autonomy than, say, women in the aristocracy or in business circles. An example, in household economies, cottage industries, making things for sale, where the household is the production unit, you cannot have women thoroughly and totally subjugated simply to keep men, to keep a patriarchal society, because the household unit has to come first. The household, the ie, is the primary unit of Japanese society anyway, and women are an integral part of that. There's a great deal of patriarchy. Men rule the society as a society, but at the household level, you cannot keep women, for example, uneducated, because if the boys in the family are dumb, somebody has to run the household, or the household suffers. So women are educated. They have to add, subtract, multiply. They have to read. You know, they have to be able to do contracts. They have to do a lot of things. So they cannot be simply subjugated. It's very important that the ie continue, and that the ie as a household be able to compete. So on that level alone, you have lots and lots of women who have something to say. Now, they may not be able to say it in the same way that boys do to their parents or to their fathers and whatnot, but they say it. And in matchmaking, for example, and choosing suitors, the whole way in which marriages are arranged allow for not just the men who are part of the match, but the women to exercise a veto. And they do. And so that's why there are serial matches that are omiai that are arranged. And for the most part, the women are allowed some considerable leeway in determining whom they're going to marry. And the picture bride situation, my understanding of that is that in some cases, these were, in many cases, these were women with some sense of agency, that they didn't like the men in the village. They wanted to get out of Japan. They wanted the freedom to exercise some level of choice. Now, many of them, we're told, were misled. Pictures of husbands who, you know, sent photographs from a decade earlier, or of better-looking friends, or of themselves in a suit in front of a big building when they lived in a shack, you know, that kind of stuff. So there is all of that, and I think many of the stories are true.
I guess that's it.
Mm.
I think we're
great.
Done. I need to get just 2 minutes of us not talking. So I don't know. Do you want to go get water or something?